progeny, and that therefore his only immortality lay in the fact that he had a son. All of this rounding him out made him not only less conscious of his own conduct, but made him comparatively indifferent to the future. The modern materialist, to the degree that he is a materialist, neither accepts nor rejects, as we understand it, any concept of life beyond the grave. To him there is neither heaven nor hell, there is only darkness. Certainly it is true that he got rid of hell, but in so doing he got rid of heaven with it, because he could not accept one polarity without the other. So the idea of retribution or penalty beyond the grave could not extend beyond the honor of his name, or that perhaps his children might suffer from his evil reputation or his unhelpful habits. All these things locked him more and more within the only escape that he knew, and that is the escape of power, of physical glory, of the building of empire, of the waging of war, of heroism, barbarism, and death in the name of progress. This concept, then, was exactly the career that Mephisto had in mind. For Mephisto represents this great escape mechanism. It represents the psychological alliance of man with the material world. And he signs a pact with materialism that if materialism will serve him for 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, whatever the pact may be, that he in turn will give himself to materialism, and that when the time comes he will lie down in the open grave and join the dust of his ancestors. There is nothing more to it. The material earth will swallow him up. Great Pan will take his own. And in the end, it makes no difference anyway. The good and the bad, the rich and the poor, the great and the small, come to a common end, and there are no pockets in shrouds. So the end is the hopelessness and despair that materialism offers only as the inducement for those who sign a pact with her ways and dedicate themselves to her service. So once having achieved its union with materialism, the human mind now suddenly discovers that there are many things it can do. It has been given a demon or a spirit for a servant. It has been given electricity. It has been given chemistry, magnetism. It has been given mathematics, astronomy, music, art, literature, everything. And it can use these things as it pleases without moral curb or ethical fear, because it makes no difference whether we are the hero or the knave. Have our way as long as we can. Command what we can command, rule what we can rule, and prepare to die. This was a rather gallant deal in its own way, and it freed Faust entirely from all moral restraint, from all of the ancient doctrines which would have told him that the path of glory led but to the grave. It freed him to go on, but it also placed him under a penalty. For in the signing of the pact, Faust made a strange kind of pledge to Mephisto, saying to him, "If ever to the passing hour I say, oh stay, thou art so fair, then to thee I give the power to drag me down to hell's despair. Then may my fate no longer linger. Then from my service thou art free. Fall from the clock the index finger. Be time all over then for me." And I think that that is exactly what happens. For the moment we stop, the moment we pause, the moment we have peace, even for an instant, the tremendous fallacy of the entire project bursts through upon us. We cannot relax. We cannot stop for one moment this frightening, fearful quest of the next instant. Because if we pause, if we consider, if we seek one substantial joy in this entire picture, the whole pageantry of our pact falls to pieces around our ears. So we must keep going. We must never think. We must never question. We must never doubt. We must hurtle our way on, never pausing long enough to reflect upon a single action, or else the madness of our pact becomes immediately obvious to us. And then in the course of all this, in this ravishing of nature, of this exploiting and spoiling of the world in which we have come to live, man's complete dedication to materialism is revealed in his betrayal of Marguerite, or the betrayal of his own soul. He not only betrays the soul in the sense of his own inner psychic life, but he betrays the collective soul of mankind. He betrays the natural good. He perverts the natural hope. He diminishes the natural love, which is in all things. And Faust, and particularly through Goethe, gives us a clue to this, because we know that Goethe was essentially much interested in the educational theories of Europe. He realized that the Faustians, under the control of the Mephisto instinct, were gradually but inevitably closing in upon the minds of the collective body of mankind. Education was being twisted and turned away from idealism into realism. Step by step, the dreams of men were being destroyed in the name of truth, in the name of fact, in the name of scientific knowledge, until little by little, the psychic life of the race, the principle of the redeeming power of the normal, natural, internal instinct of man, was being perverted, so that man no longer had available to him the inner guidance of his own soul or of his own spiritual conviction. This soul had been betrayed and turned to madness by the ambitions of this false lover, who apparently, coming as a handsome youth, was really this individual bound only by obligation to power and ambition. Now, in the story, as we develop it in the original poem, Faust never really repents. Faust is never actually sorry for what he did. But something happens that takes the place of that repentance. And that is the thing, perhaps, that even Mephisto intuitively knew. Because if Faust is suffering from a very grave emergency of character, Mephisto, embodying as he does the entire rebellion of the mortal mind against divine mind, is in a still more difficult position, because Mephisto is a god. Mephisto is a being who can stand at the very footstool of the Almighty and talk back to God himself. In Mephisto's consciousness, there are no illusions. Mephisto knows the game, he knows how it is played, and he knows its inevitable end. Mephisto suffers from the fatal realization that as the adversary, he must lose. He may have a long period of apparent victory, but Mephisto knows that this ancient foundation, which has endured from the beginning, the eternal throne, will ultimately vanquish all of the works of darkness. So Mephisto is not deceived by his own role, although at times he prefers to ignore it. And I think in a way that this also plays a part in what we may call materialistic knowledge today. I don't think there is a materialist, regardless of his addiction to limited perspective, who actually believes that he has the answer. I think he knows within himself that he is on some kind of a treadmill, that he is in some kind of a situation from which he can see no escape, but which does not lead to solution. And I think this knowledge has become especially obvious to him in the last 25 to 50 years, where of all men, the trained thinker, the scientist, the skilled intellectual realizes the desperate and dangerous game that he is playing, and realizes that along the path he is following may well come inevitable disaster. Perhaps this is why the Massachusetts Institute of Technology suddenly decided to include a course on the humanities in its physics department. It suddenly began to realize that this generation this generation of young minds that had taken or signed their pact with Mephisto, with power, with skill, with knowledge without good, that these young people were getting to be too dangerous to themselves and too dangerous to their instructors. That all this knowledge could well ultimately lead to a holocaust which would destroy everything that man has ever built. And so Mephisto, representing and embodying this headlong course of action, is not entirely happy about it himself. But he prances about and dances about and never reveals to Faust the melancholy in his own nature. In the great poem, as it is completely unfolded, Faust is divided as a story into two parts. The one part beginning, I would say, on a religious level. The beginning, the first step, or the highest part, being essentially religious. It then descends into the second part, which is essentially philosophical, and finally falls into the third section, which is essentially ethical. And in the ethical part, we find the final descent of Faust through the compromise and destruction of his own ethical code. So that the first part of Faust together is a fall through three worlds, through a spiritual, intellectual, and material state, and final tragedy on the level of materialism. The second part of Faust, which is sometimes referred to as the redemption of Faust, is so fantastic in its structure and so elaborate in its presentation that it would almost defy an adequate theatrical presentation, except probably on the level of a very expensive motion picture, as it could be done today. But in the old days, it was not stageable in any kind of an adequate manner. In this, we have what might be termed the redemption of Faust. But this redemption begins upon a moral level, gradually ascends through what might be termed an ethical level, and finally achieves its consummation on a platform which we might almost term mystical or metaphysical. The essential theme of it being that Faust is not redeemed by any direct repentance of his own, nor is he redeemed by any vicarious intercession. He is redeemed primarily by one thing: what he himself has learned. In other words, Faust is redeemed by a series of experiences which transform him, until by transforming his own inner life, he achieves a state of consciousness in which he can no longer be held by his pact to Mephistopheles. He simply outgrows it. And in the process of outgrowing it, he escapes the pact. He cannot break it, but he can transcend it. And in the transcending of it, he arrives at a state in which the fiend is completely baffled. And he is strangely redeemed, almost as we find in the Divine Comedy of Dante. If you remember when the time came for Dante to rise out of the Purgatorio, or to come out of the underworld, he did so by climbing up upon the very body of the demon itself, which was the only way out. And Faust, in the story of his relation with Mephistopheles, is actually saved by Mephistopheles himself. It is a subtle thing, but it is actually there. Because it is this power, this energy of evil, constantly forcing him on, that finally causes him to break with evil. It causes him to recognize, as Mephisto himself had earlier said, that he was part of a power that works for good while ever scheming ill. And through the entire story, Mephisto is leading Faust to a great and complete disillusionment. A disillusionment with everything that pertained to the glories and honors and dignities of materialism. They were exhausted by the very circumstances, until finally, for Faust, this world and its entire pattern of glory no longer held any fascination, nor was no longer pleasant, was no longer fulfillment, but became a heavy and terrible burden upon him. Therefore, he more or less voluntarily makes the break. Now, in the case of Dante, the journey through the Inferno is accompanied by Virgil, the guide, the all-sufficient guide who leads him on. But when he comes to the Paradiso, Dante comes under the guidance of Beatrice, a beautiful and wonderful symbol used by the old troubadours to represent Sophia, the great wisdom of the world. The same, in another way, happens also to Faust, because in his search for reality, we come upon that wonderful line that the eternal feminine leads him on. It is the soul, actually, which finally rescues him. But it is a soul that has been changed from an innocent girl to a very wise and almost prophetess-like woman, a symbol of all knowledge, skill, and attainment. A very different type of psychic integration than that which is suggested in the first part of the story. And so Faust completes his wonderful cycle and finally is redeemed, not by a redeeming power, but by what we might term the negative redemption of disillusionment. Faust suddenly discovers the complete and total emptiness of the thing through which he has passed and what he has experienced. And in this phase, I'm always reminded very strongly of the parallel that we find in the writings of Jacob Böhme, the German mystic of Görlitz. This shoemaker gives us a very interesting parallel of the relations between God and demon. Because we are carried in the allegory or in the fable out into space. And in space we find one brooding figure standing upon a great cloud with folded wings of sable hue. A great brooding figure leaning upon a sword and standing looking out into the infinite. And this brooding figure is Satan. And this brooding figure is almost divine in its own right. For within it is not only the creative power of God, but the infinite courage and strength of the divine will. And this being has come out of the mysteries of outer space to stand before the throne of the Almighty and to offer itself as a vassal of God. And it stands there and it speaks. And it sends its voice out into the great mysterious darkness that lies about it, out towards one softly roseate cloud that seems to be hovering over the great vistas of space like some dim northern light. And the powerful angel calls out and asks God to reveal himself. And out of the cloud and out of the mystery and out of the darkness comes the voice of a baby, a very tiny child. And this voice of the child, so faint, so small, so gentle, as to hardly be audible, says, "Yes, did you wish to speak to me?" And in that moment, Satan is so completely shocked and so completely baffled that he leans upon his sword and thinks, "Is this voice, this child voice, this voice alone in space, is this God? And if this is God, what can we expect of divinity? Here are all the clouds, the stars, and the cosmos. Are they to be managed and directed by a small child? Where is the glorious court of heaven? Where are the choirs of the angels and the archangels and the seraphs and the cherubim? Where are the principalities and the powers and the dominions? Nothing there but the voice of a child speaking gently in the voice of love." And Satan says to himself, "I guess I'd better do something about this. This is no way to run a universe. And if this is the measure of things, I think I'd better take over." So in this moment, Satan rebels against the Lord. And in this moment, when in his mind comes the thought, I will take over, I will be the King of Kings and the ruler of the world, in that instant, the heavens are shattered from edge to edge. The sky rolls back. The clouds break open. And out of this mist and darkness and out of these rosy shadows, there bursts a light that strikes upon Satan with such a tremendous power that he is cast down upon his knees. And there suddenly before him, in all of its effulgent glory, is the God of might and the God of battles. The soft voice has disappeared, and now stands all the glory of the armies of the Lord under the psychopompus of the Archangel Michael. And here are the hosts of heaven in their golden armor, and an ineffable glory and an ineffable strength beyond all human understanding. And Satan cannot understand. He does not know what has happened. And the voice explains to him that when he came in gentleness and humility of speech, of speech and appeal, he was brought into the presence of the great meekness, which is God. For God is always the gentle voice to those who come in obedience. But God is always the voice that is almost impossible to hear, the childish little voice of those who obey. But the moment there comes into the mind of man arrogance, worldliness, and power, the God of meekness disappears, and there is beheld the vessels of wrath. In that instant, the sky opens, and the power of the heavens is revealed, is revealed in all its glory. Not because heaven has changed, but because rebellion has changed the sight of the one who beheld it. The glory was always there, but the meek in heart see only the meekness, but the proud behold only the wrath. And this was the battle between the divine mind and the mortal mind, between the will of heaven and the will of man. And in this great battle, man by disobedience released the wrath and came under the power of the retribution of natural law. Man knows of no laws until he breaks them. Man knows of no wrath until he disobeys. Man is not aware that there is in the universe anything but beauty until he breaks the law. And this was Bamy's expression or interpretation of the rebellion and the fall of the archangel Lucifer and his hosts and the great war in heaven. And this, in substance, is also the burden of the concept in Faust, because the two stories have almost identical meaning. Faust, in his original sincerity, was searching for the world of God. When he could not find it, he rebelled. And in his mental rebellion, his discouragement, his resignation to negative inevitables, he opened himself to the retribution of mortal mind. A mortal mind, or selfish mind, represented by Mephisto, becomes his servant. But mortal mind leads man only to self-destruction, leads him only to ways of darkness and evil, and finally results in his complete undoing. In the end of the first part of the play, however, this false thinking, having brought Faust to the lowest pitch of tragedy, we find the revulsion taking place within himself. The revulsion which finally, through a kaleidoscopic series of circumstances, brings him back again to the recognition that the good man, even in his infirmity, will cling unto the Lord who made him be. And that he will find in the end the only answer to the whole great conflict. And that answer is simple faith. The simple acceptance of truth itself as a principle, whether he can possess it, know it, or understand it or not. The simple return to obedience. And the moment he obeys, the wrath vanishes and the power of the tempter is destroyed. So by returning to the original destiny and the nature which was his proper place in the world, the entire mystery or story is brought to its magnificent and dramatic conclusion. Now, we know that Faust was dramatized in a great many ways at early periods in medieval history. We know that it was almost, at one time, a miracle play. It was part of the concept of the moral growth of humanity. And there is no question that the larger implications lie on the psychological level. And on this level, we have certain structure also to analyze. We have, for instance, to realize that man, as ego, as selfhood, the hero of the world, so to speak, must be played by Faust. We know also that man possesses a power which is called will. And we know that this power of will, as Buddha has well pointed out to us, is in a wonderful and strange way the supreme adversary with which man has to contend in his search for reality. We know that it is man's will to be, will to do, will to have, and will to know, that these willings are in a subtle and mysterious manner absolutely contrary to the law of truth. We know that the individual creates for himself misery, darkness, and death by the exercise of his own will over the principle of universal reality. Man, demanding to do as he wills, creates the situation that ultimately brings him to the precarious edge of self-destruction. Buddha points this out very definitely. Misery is due to the exercise of the will. The individual who wills creates adversary because the very motion of will produces its inevitable negative result. And man can never achieve truth by will. Man achieves truth not by conquest, not by reaching out with the tremendous courage of his own imagination, nor with the power of his own purposes. Man achieves error by action, by will, by the exertion of faculties and powers. Man attains truth by complete relaxation, by complete acceptance, by the complete renunciation of self-will in the presence of divine will. Therefore, as Lao Tzu so well points out, the way of reality, or the path to Tao, is the effortless effort. The effort in which there is no self-purpose, but man gradually coming into adjustment with universal purpose, described by Lao Tzu as motion, the universal Tao, or the motion of the infinite in all things. Thus man, by attaining conscious conformity with the rhythm of being, becomes identical with being. This he does by fulfilling the simple biblical admonition, "Be still and know that I am God." Through the stillness, through what Meyer the Rosicrucian calls the silentium post clamoris, or the silence after the sound and the striving, the sound and the fury, man, by renunciation of self-will, redeems himself from the tyranny of this strange, fantastic energy, which he has apparently forever at his disposal. In doing according to his own will, what does man do? From the exercise of self-will comes first the experience of self-existence. Man wills his own ego into existence. He wills himself to say, "I am," which is the primary impulse of his will. Having thus affirmed his own existence and having centered himself in the midst of his own hypothetical circle, man then says, "Because I am, I can do. I can be, I can have, I can know." So having created all of these concepts, he proceeds to follow them as Wallace followed the heart of Bruce in battle. He tosses the heart ahead of him and goes in and dies to follow it. Having created selfness, the individual can possess, he can lose, he can gain. He can pass through innumerable experiences, all of them on the plane of illusion. He can capture, he can loose, because he has accepted or assumed the reality of his own will nature, his own mortal mind controlling all things. The end of this is Schopenhauer's Superman, the man with the will to power, the will to power of Nietzsche. This tremendous being who is to conquer all things by the indefatigable exertion of the will to be, the will to do, and the will to have. All these willings together can only result also in the will to overcome the will of another willing creature. So we have the conflict of will, and we have a very disorderly universe in which everyone, with his own will, is attempting to overwhelm the will of everyone else. Each individual, therefore, feels all obstruction or obstacle as an immovable object opposing the expression of his own inevitable force. This is the world of force, the world of intrigue, the world of plot and counterplot. And this will is again identified with the Mephisto concept. Now what happens when we start all this willing? All willing leads to what might be termed the grand frustration. Because no matter what we will, we never quite make it. We are never able to overcome boundaries over which the will has no dominion. We follow this will of the wisp toward the success we seek, only to tumble into a grave instead. We have the achievement which we have longed for, and learn that we have paid for it with health and happiness and friendship, so that when we have it, it is meaningless. So this will ends constantly in psychosis. The more tremendously we exercise selfhood, the sicker we get, day by day, year by year, until we become what are known as psychotics. And these psychotics are individuals who by their own conduct have diseased their own souls. For these psychoses develop frustrations, fixations, neuroses, phobias, introversions, manias, and innumerable other ailments, so that one by one, all these excesses become a corrupting influence that moves in upon the psychic life of the individual, perverts it and destroys it, and finally brings man into a state of internal psychic sickness. And this internal psychic sickness is the betrayal of his own soul, in this case, Marguerite, whose personal life and happiness he has destroyed, and who therefore, appropriately, as in the case of the psychotic, she ends in madness and self-destruction. The soul, therefore, is the victim. The victim of every excess is registered in the invisible bodies of man to become the basis of psychic sickness. The thought forms, the emotional forms, these monsters of negation, described by Paracelsus as the incubus and the succubus, all these things are the creations of selfishness, degeneracy in the psychic atmosphere of man. And they arise one and all, as Buddha tells us, from the simple seed of selfishness, self-will, the determination of the individual to succeed at the expense of truth. So in his headlong journey to the gratification of his every desire, Faust betrays his own soul, reduces and destroys this one who trusts upon him, misrepresents himself to her, and finally brings her in madness and sorrow to an untimely end. Thus the entire psychic drama within man himself is adequately and properly played out. Faust, of course, at this time in the opera, is supposed to be dragged down to the inferno with his infernal master. But in the larger version of the story, he wanders on comparatively untouched by the misery that he has caused. He goes out then trying to forget the damage he has done. Just as the materialist and the average individual having caused great sorrow by his own misdeeds, goes on in his endless course of forgetfulness. And in small ways and little manners and things that we do every day, many of our so-called escape mechanisms are simply the effort to forget the injustice we have done to our own psychic integrity. And when we follow almost any escapism that is not essentially good, it is because we can no longer endure the mysterious psychic imbalance which we have created within ourselves. And so we start on this strange, wandering mystery of travel to heaven and hell, to all kinds of strange spheres and romantic places, got carried on the wings of the wind by our ever-present Mephistopheles, who is ever there to oblige, and who is to change the world into a fantasy for us, a fantasy of imagination and delusion, anything to help us to forget. But ultimately we cannot forget, because we have broken rules, broken patterns, and have formed false alliances with the principles and energies ruling life. So in the end, we come finally to the termination of our course, sadder but wiser. And out of all of this tremendous extravaganza, we come finally to the realization that by a strange, gentle, sensitive acceptance of the divine will, we release ourselves from all these strange and difficult experiences, and at the same time confound the fiend who thinks he has come to possess us. Now, very much the same thing is recorded in the lives of a great many individuals of importance, particularly in religion. We remember, for instance, the career of Saint Augustine, who never ceased to reproach himself for the iniquities and injustices which he had committed in his earlier life, and devoted much of his years to repentance. We also find the same story in the case of Saint Francis de Assis, who, starting out as a very physical and worldly person, finally realized that this path could not lead to happiness or peace. The Faustian story then, of course, takes on the attitudes and attributes of the man forgetting himself, or trying to, and finding that in so doing, by this negative absorption of his own life into materialism, he has destroyed the very best of his own character and his own nature, and has achieved nothing. Mephisto, always present as temptation, representing excuse, evasion, any substantiation or substitution that is necessary to make the illusion more beautiful, more apparent, but no more substantial, is the whole body, the entire concept of evasion and avoidance, the endless compromising which we do in the effort to make things easier. All of these elements have been rather carefully examined on a psychological level to determine the natures and attributes of all these parts and their places in our philosophical life. If we go back to the consideration of ourselves as the symbols of Faust, if we place ourselves psychologically as the principal actor in this cosmic drama of moral and ethic, then we must realize that each of us, during the course of life, passes much through the cycle that is described in this story. Each individual passes through the periods of disillusionment, in which the values and ideas which he thought were real crumble around him. Every time a dream fades, every time a hope apparently is destroyed, man falls into negative patterns and negative ways. And in each case, he must make his decisions, whether he will follow along the lines of success and compromise, or whether he will stay with his principles. And of course, the larger path of compromise, represented by the vast motion of the world around him, is the ever-alluring prospect of the pact with Mephisto. The world seems to offer so much to the individual who will compromise his own integrity. He can be almost sure of becoming richer. He can be almost certain that he will become more famous. He will be advanced to the degree that his morals do not interfere with his progress. Consequently, not so very long ago, here in the city of Los Angeles, the school board decided to make a noble experiment. They decided to introduce into the classwork each day a new program to begin each morning with a very brief reading of a few lines or a sentence or two from some great spiritual or moral leader, preferably not one of the four or five associated with the outstanding religions because of creedal problems. But it was decided that it would be nice to open the day with a great thought from Socrates, or a great line from Confucius, or a wonderful verse of Plato, to start the young people off right. What happened? All the parents stormed the teachers' room down at the city hall where the Board of Education met and asked to have this discontinued. A mass meeting was held of irate parents. One of these parents got up and said, "We do not want our children to be taught ethics, because if they become ethical, they will be economic failures. We want you to teach them to be business people. We want you to educate them in business, but we do not want you to interfere with their ethics, because the more ethical they become, the poorer they will be. And we want rich and successful children." So that would be very largely, just exactly, old Mephisto moving in on the situation. Leave out the ethics, leave out the morality, give us the facts. Well, these facts, as represented by scientific materialism, are a strange and wonderful and powerful and terrible thing. They represent strength, power, almost inconceivable. When we think of Mephisto carrying Faust around the world in the glance of an eye, we are thinking perhaps of aeroplanes. When he can carry messages and he can see things in other parts of the world, perhaps television, radio, the telephone, long before these things were invented, were already parts of this great magical world that Mephisto could open to Faust. But in order to live in it, Faust must sign this pact and exchange his soul for the conveniences and commodities of his time. Every time we go in debt, we do the same thing. Every time we spend beyond our means, we sell something of our soul for a bowl of pottage. We do it because we place ourselves in a position where we are indebted to our world, where we have formed a pact, where we have made a contract, which we must keep, even if it is at the expense and compromise of our principles. The heavier we become in debt, the more we must compromise. The greater our demand for luxuries, the more we must compromise. Thus, every day in every way, the individual becomes more and more enmeshed in this strange sphere of illusion and fantasy. He signs the pact with his own blood and pays for it with his own life. That these principles should exist in this way, that this great moral drama should have been preserved so carefully, and at the same time not more deeply have influenced the life of mankind, shows how strangely the fascination of materialism has closed in upon man. A fascination which makes him willing to ignore the magnificent opportunity to be a person, to be a great human being in substance and spirit, and has made him willing to exchange possessions for the self-possession which he has lost. So in the story of Faust, we have the great compromise, the compromise that must always end in tragedy. And as we look out at the United Nations, as we look out at Suez and Hungary, as we look out at China, as we look around the world today and see the great compromise, anything to avoid the facing of facts, anything to prevent a break in this strange, twisted system which has gradually come to control us and dominate us, we begin to see that perhaps in a subtle, mysterious, symbolical way, a very large part of mankind has signed the pact in blood and must pay in blood. And that the story of Faust is actually the tragedy of any individual who, turning from solution within himself upon a level of ethics, seeks through compromise to attain comfort and convenience. All that he gains is what modern man has gained: debt, inconvenience, suffering, and death. So the devil has his due, regardless of anything else. But through this, and this alone, Mephisto attains the purposes intended in the divine mind. For it is only, apparently, through the tragedies of abuse and misuse that man finally grows to the point of his own redemption. And having redeemed himself through a clearer understanding of his own inner life, he is able to break or transcend the pact, free his soul, and escape from the clutches of mortal mind, selfishness, sin, and death, the last enemies to be overcome. This, in my estimation, carries at least a part of the moral ethical implication of Faust, and gives us, it seems to me, the foundation upon which the drama was built, not only by Goethe, but also by Marlowe, and most of all, the great prologue in the Book of Job. All of these things fit together and tell us that the story is man's compromise with truth. His corruption, his fall, his betrayal of his fellow man, represented by Marguerite, finally experience disillusionment, an ultimate regeneration and redemption through the acceptance of self-responsibility and the gradual resigning of his mortal mind and mortal will to obedience to the divine law. As Lord Bacon said, the end of knowledge is that man shall obey. And it is in this line of ultimate obedience to truth that the triumphant chord of the ultimate strokes of this great drama will be found sounded clearly and magnificently. The story that begins in heaven ends in heaven, but there are long, dark days on earth in between. Well, I think that is our...